Welcome to the program for Monday, November 19th, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, taking a look at some advice. Advice for Congress and advice for the Office of Management and Budget from three people who are insiders from that world. The advice comes in the form of a paper from the Center for Strategic and International Studies called Updating U.S. Federal Cybersecurity Policy and Guidance. Three of the authors of that paper are in studio with me today. The first that I'll recognize is Karen Evans, who is now the National Director of U.S. Cyber Challenge and former Administrator of eGov at OMB. It's great to see you as always, my friend. It's nice
it's
to have you in the studio.
It's fun to be here as always.
And you are here today with Frank Reeder, who is co-founder and director of the Center for Internet Security and the National Board of Information Security Examiners. And also good to see you, my friend.
Always a pleasure.
I appreciate you taking some time to come in. And the third former OMBer on the dais today is Dan Chenick, Executive Director of the IBM Center for the Business of Government, and also good to see you.
Good to see you, Francis.
Thank you all very much, the three of you, for being here. You're great friends of the show, and this work is only 20 pages, and I think anybody who knows you would have expected a whole lot more. But this 20 pages is full of advice for updating a document called Circular A-130. Frank, I'll start with you to explain what A-130 was, where it came from, to give us some context about what you're writing about here.
By the way, let the record show that Francis took the first shot. OMB Circular A-130 is actually an umbrella document that was first crafted in the early 1980s as the directive that covered OMB's guidance on a range of subjects. I think its pretentious title is Management of Information Resources, because that was the in-vogue phrase at the time. The focus of the paper that we collaborated on was the cybersecurity portion of that directive that actually derives from directives that were issued even earlier. That portion, the appendix on cybersecurity and the piece in the main circular, have been revised several times, but it was our view that the events in the interim and the absence of legislation argued for a look at it again.
Now, Congress has been batting around cybersecurity legislation, it seems like, for decades, longer than they actually have been. Karen, what's missing in what Frank talked about and what already exists that you wanted to address in taking a look at this?
So there's a couple pieces with the existing legislation, the Federal Information Security Management Act. First and foremost, that was passed and there was no Department of Homeland Security. So this goes without saying that a major policy document at the Office of Management and Budget should recognize the roles and responsibilities beyond just what the director is responsible for, but the act like goes and breaks out things, for example, like an incident response center that you're supposed to have. Well, Department of Homeland Security does all of that work. And so there's a whole bunch of different things that are in there that you want to make sure that their role is very clear so that when the agencies are working with DHS, that you can go back and actually see the alignment from statute to the circular, then to the policy memo. So that's the biggest thing that, you know, is very obvious that needs to be addressed. But there are other things that as technology has evolved, as the world has changed, for example, we spent a lot of time talking about continuous monitoring and what does that mean and how to use that going forward in a policy document that you can then continuously use it to make investments and make decisions about risk and about your services.
Dan, Karen hit on a couple of things there that I wanted to go to next. And one of them is, since the original FISMA, technology's changed dramatically. And the threats to federal networks and information have changed dramatically. How much of that played into what you wanted to, the advice that you wanted to offer here?
Well, the advice that we're offering is really an amalgamation of many discussions among cybersecurity professionals and technology professionals over the last decade. 20 years ago, when you built a system, you built it in a large mainframe setting, probably in a building. And not much happened to the iron, to the hardware, over the course of time. And so it made sense to have a certification or a check on the system every few years, because you could do that and make sure that you were basically up to snuff. And so the statute and OMB policy until very recently required an every 3 year recertification called a certification and accreditation or CNA. Because technology has advanced so rapidly, because agencies are migrating to the cloud, where cloud providers are rolling out new versions of their provisioned software and infrastructure constantly, and we want that to happen. That's a good thing for the government. It's a good thing for the country. But it also requires much closer scrutiny on a regular basis of how that technology is used and how information travels across it. And continuous monitoring that Karen referred to, the report really takes the work that was pioneered by a number of officials in the administration, including John Strayford at the State Department, as well as work at CMS, at HHS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and NASA, to suggest that there is a way to approach this type of continuous change in technology and continuous flow of information by looking at cybersecurity protections continuously. So that's a big change that's been driven by the technology.
We're going to talk throughout the course of the program about the three core recommendations that you have made in this and then get some thoughts at the end of the conversation about what the next steps should be and how those next steps should happen, who should be taking them and what should be taking them. Is there anything, though, before we get into the meat of that, that we should be watching as we're watching Congress fighting about cybersecurity legislation, and one side says it's dead and the other side says it's not? And there's still a lot of moving parts there at a time where it doesn't seem like a lot's likely to happen anytime soon. Are there any markers that we should be watching in this, or any potential silver linings in the cloud or any of that?
Well, I think the discussions on the Hill, because I hearken back to my last official visit here when I said, oh, that's the one thing that's going to get done, and it still hasn't gotten done yet.
To be fair, I don't think you had a date on that.
Well, thank goodness. But it's helping define the scope. And so that's one of the biggest things. And I think what we focused on is there's a lot that still can be done just within the federal agencies and with the federal contractors that support the agencies that can really improve the cybersecurity posture for the nation. And so as the legislation is being discussed, they're really, you know, looking at the bigger scope. Do we go all the way down into critical infrastructure with this change? Should we break off the legislation as FISMA did, which was federal government assets and federal contractors who support the federal government? And I think that's achievable. But what happens is everybody starts looking at it and says, well, if you're going to go down that way, what's this one little piece? And let's add on this other piece, and let's add on this other piece. And I think that's the reason why it hasn't gone anywhere, but at least you're getting clarity as to what everybody's position is.
Without asking you to speculate on one side of the Hill or the other, are these things, do you think, more appropriately addressed, as Karen's talking about, broken into little pieces and doing the things that that members can agree on? Or is the big bill the better way to go? Frank, Dan, any thoughts on that?
Again, first person singular. A big bill will allow you to bring things along that probably wouldn't pass standalone. So in this instance, my personal view is a tactical matter. It's not that substantively one couldn't break it into pieces, but there are some things that are going to be more unpopular.
So, and I would say that it's easier often to enact smaller pieces. And it may be that the path to cybersecurity legislation is that pieces like the federal piece that Karen described, which is one particular element of various larger bills, would get attached and could be passed with wide support. Whereas that might not exist in a larger setting.
Before we move on, I do have best wishes from your co-authors on this who couldn't join us today. Jim Lewis of CSIS and Alan Powler of the Sands Institute both said to
Cowards.
Say and let it be said for the record that Frank Reeder got the second shot of the show in. We'll continue our conversation in a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM before we get too much out of control.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
The job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview, yeah. And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Want to save money on vitamins, herbal remedies, and other health care needs? Then visit Village Green Apothecary during our big year-end sale now through December 31st. You'll save 35% on our popular Pathway brand nutrition products, 25% off other supplements, and 20% off natural body care products. Visit us at 5415 West Cedar Lane in Bethesda or shop online at myvillagegreen.com. And be sure to catch our top-notch radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, every Sunday at 10 a.m. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Zymogen and Metagenics.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday on 1500 AM. Join me this week for my special guest, John Allen, founder of Bluestone Capital Partners. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area. For more information about the firm, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
This is John Gilroy from Armature and host of Federal Tech Talk. After almost 300 interviews, I've had many guests who talk about cutting-edge technology and agile software development. How would you like to be part of a fast-paced team with an agile approach to projects? We need talent. We seek experts in .NET, WCF, jQuery, and HTML5. Take advantage of this opportunity where you can make a difference. For more information, go to armaturecorp.com or send your resume to radiojobs@armaturecorp.com.
A meningitis outbreak, post-hurricane health concerns, a new food safety law, all part of the FDA's mission. But can the agency do it all? I'm Emily Kopp. On Tuesday's Federal Drive, the Pew Charitable Trusts releases a new report on the FDA workforce. And NIST's Chuck Romine measures health IT. It starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests on the program today, Karen Evans, Frank Reeder, and Dan Chenick, talking about a document called Updating U.S. Federal Cybersecurity Policy and Guidance. It is intended to be recommendations to update Circular A-130 at the Office of Management and Budget. And you can read the paper linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. There are three main recommendations that you write about in this. I want to start, though, with this passage. You folks write, our most important recommendation involves continuous monitoring of network operations. Now, continuous monitoring, fairly unfair or unfairly, seems to be one of these terms that different people have different definitions of. So for our purposes, Karen, you're nodding your head, so you get to answer this one first. Give us the definition for the purposes of your examination of what continuous monitoring is and what it should be.
So what it should be is automation of configurations, automation of your risk level. It's not what it is not, and I just saw another article on this the other day, and I forgive me for everybody who's a big fan in South Carolina. So South Carolina just had a big breach, and what they've come out with on their security plan is we're going to have continuous monitoring. We're going to have people in a security operations center for 24 hours a day. That it's not people looking at monitors 24 hours a day. It's automating as much as you can. So, for example, the SANS 20 critical controls. You know, other countries are looking at this. They're going across the board. If you automate and you agree upon the first four, the top four of these, and there's countries that are doing this, and there's a group that is out there, you can fix almost 80 to 85% of the issues that are out there with the agencies. And it would clear out the noise so that you could actually be focused on the higher risk areas. So it's automating as much as you can and then monitoring it, not having people looking at a monitor for 24/7.
And if I may continue in that vein, it's not monitoring the content. It is monitoring the security status of
right.
the system.
So you're monitoring for security anomalies right. is what you're looking
it's
for.
It's not surveillance of individual behavior mm-hmm. at all. So it's not individually identifiable, doesn't really raise privacy issues in that sense. As Karen said, by automating and doing what the term of art is automated indicator sharing, right? So you see an indicator of a problem and machines can basically link with machines and stop that problem immediately. A piece of malware, for example, and a lot of the sort of small scale stuff that comes across can get resolved that way so that the people can really focus on the more significant, more persistent threats.
Now, the next sentence in this report, as I'm going to guess, is one that was written by our friend Alan Paller, because I hear his voice in this. Government security experts have told us the current regime of periodic reports and certifications requires them to spend tens of millions of dollars on reports and processes that do little to enhance security. Now, he was just on this show last week talking about admiring the cybersecurity problem as opposed to finding solutions to it. And I'm sure you all have heard him say that on any number of occasions. How does continuous monitoring fix that? How do the processes deal with that, or is there some kind of policy behind that that has to change?
Let me harken back to the earlier discussion you and I had a few minutes ago. So what Alan's talking about are the large sets of books and reports that get produced every 3 years or 2 years as they do a broad view of a particular system or set of systems. It does require basically a policy shift, because you could have continuous monitoring and also still have all of that back-end process stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so the policy shift that the report recommends is that you still want to have good process. We're not suggesting that you get rid of understanding where the threats are and doing especially up front when a system's first introduced, making sure that you've got everything assessed and you've got proper documentation, but really making the emphasis over time to really one that's more operational, more that's responsive, reactive, can be predictive of threats, as opposed to forcing people to fill out lots of checklists, nine questions out of 10 of which don't have much to do with an actual threat.
And it strikes me that in a fully automated continuous monitoring regime like Karen just talked about a moment ago, you should be able to design that system in such a way so that at pretty much any time somebody says, I would like to know how we look, somebody can push a button and give you a report on how it looks, and it doesn't have to be every 3 years, let's start from scratch and generate a big notebook full of paper.
So that's exactly the point. So based on everything that Dan and Frank and I have been talking about, the reports that Alan is so adamantly against, that we've had huge debates about, and he and I have had huge debates about this, it's the process of managing risk, right? So just like Dan said, you don't want to get rid of that. And if we do the continuous monitoring right and you automate it right, then having a dashboard or having a report, the product that he's talking about, that what came about through certification and accreditation, that was the wrong focus, right? That's the wrong outcome. The product of having a whole series of reports does not make you more secure. The product of continuous monitoring will improve the security level, will reduce risk. And the byproduct is the report. Because if you're doing it right, you print out a report, just like you said, and the auditors can go and take a look at the results of the transactions.
Okay. This report also says agencies can better implement continuous monitoring through work led by chief information officers and chief information security officers. And you go on to reference another part of the report that will talk about how that can happen. This gets to an issue, though, that all three of us, I think, have talked about individually before, but I don't know if we've talked about collectively, and that is, what's the role of the chief information officer going to look like 5 years from now if these recommendations are implemented compared to what it looks like today? And it strikes me that it will be dramatically different, which then takes me to the next level, which is the role of the CIO is being pulled a number of different directions and for a number of different reasons. And I wonder whether we might be in a situation where we're trying to pull that person in that role too many different directions at the same time, where that person's asked to be now a budget expert and work very closely with the CFO at an agency to be able to take some autonomy when it comes to budget issues. And now here, this is a much higher level of technological integration into the fabric of the agency. Am I on the right track, do you think,
Dan? This is a large topic. It's one that Karen and I have talked about many times. And, of course, Frank was at OMB when the position of CIO was created in statute in Clinger-Cohen. The middle name of CIO is information. It's not information technology. And the evolution of the position, I think, really needs to look at technology will change over time. We'll move from mainframes to client servers to cloud, into social media, into mobility. But all of those vehicles are about information executives in agencies and in companies who are responsible for making sure that information is safe, that it efficiently transfers from one place to another within the company and with or the agency and with the people whom it's collecting information from and giving information to. And so if the CIO looks at their job that way, then the continuous monitoring is just information's coming in, it's going out, we're looking at what's happening to it, we're looking at the safety of it, it becomes part of a larger flow. Whereas if you look at it more like how you were describing, which is sometimes a traditional view of a CIO function, you do tend to segment things into, well, there's the security piece and there's the technology piece and there's the data piece. And that's really not, at least I think, how a CIO in the 21st century wants to function.
Yeah, and if you look at what's happening to the technology piece is becoming a commodity, whether it's the desktop or the cloud. And I hate to agree so wildly in public, but I think Dan's got it absolutely right. I have a slightly different view of what one needs to do or whether one needs to empower the CIO qua CIO. That, to me, is an organizational question that's sort of second or maybe third order. But I think the function that Dan describes of securing information is what's critical.
We'll talk more about that when we come back, because that's one of the major recommendations here. My guests in studio today are Frank Reeder, who you just heard, Dan Chenick right before him, and Karen Evans, all of them co-authors, along with Alan Paller and Jim Lewis, of a document called Updating U.S. Federal Cybersecurity Policy and Guidance, released through the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we'll continue our conversation in just a minute on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
For a faster, easier way for your agency to go green, choose GSA's Green Aisles, the custom online purchasing channels on GSA Advantage and GSA Global Supply. Each item in the Green Aisles is identified and labeled with environmental indicators like Energy Star, EPEAT, and more, so you can find the green products and services you need and meet all of your agency's sustainability requirements, environmental and economic. To learn more, join the conversation today at interact.gsa.gov/sustainability.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does three decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time. But the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit CapitalAreaFoodBank.org.
Every year, someone checks out the safety of your car and tunes it up. Why? Because you want to make sure your friends and family are safe when traveling, and it improves the performance of your car, including its gas mileage. So what about your house? When was the last time you had someone give it a once-over for health and safety issues related to mold, mildew, gas leaks, or carbon monoxide backdrafting from gas-fired appliances? Would you know if you were paying more than you needed to for your energy and water every month? Want to find out? The Local Energy Alliance Program, or LEAP, is a community-based nonprofit that helps homeowners with these issues. LEAP works with local government and utilities to provide residents a one-stop shop of who to call, what to do, and how to pay for it for home energy improvements. LEAP is knowledgeable, trustworthy, and local. Contact LEAP today at ilikeleap.com. That's ilikeleap.com.
If you raise high the buff in blue, now's your chance to win prizes for showing your commitment to the Colonials. Visit RaiseHighRewards.com now and start earning points for your likes, retweets, shares, check-ins, and more with GW Athletics content from GWSports.com and social media properties. Registration is free, and you can win special fan experiences, ticket upgrades, and buff in blue gear. Visit RaiseHighRewards.com now.
Supplementing teens. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Burgers, pizza, and soda are not a wholesome diet, although lots of teens might wish it. Fruits and vegetables, fish, and dairy products are part of a wholesome diet, but lots of teens don't like them. So researchers have been looking at ways to make up at least part of what's missing by vitamin and mineral supplements. At the National Institutes of Health, Reagan Bailey examined national survey data. She says teens are the least likely people to take supplements. She says supplements could help them, but supplements are not the entire solution.
Calcium and vitamin D intakes were low, even among those who were using a dietary supplement.
Dairy products have calcium, and some types of fish, as well as dairy products like milk and yogurt, have vitamin D. The study was in the Journal of Pediatrics. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Human capital management for the federal government is the most anticipated training event this year, featuring more than 30 participating federal human chief capital officers and chief learning officers. Don't miss this year's event, to be held on November 28th through the 30th, 2012, at the Sheraton Pentagon City Hotel in Arlington, Virginia. Check out the website, www.hcmfederal.com, for more information and to register now. Mention code HCMF for a $200 discount.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, looking at a document released by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a synopsis of potential changes for circular A-130, recommendations coming from Frank Reeder, Dan Chenick, Karen Evans, Jim Lewis, and Alan Paller under the title Updating U.S. Federal Cybersecurity Policy and Guidance. And Frank, Dan, and Karen are in studio with me today. Now, Dan, one of the things you and I were talking about just a moment ago was the focus, and you mentioned correctly, Chief Information Officer doesn't imply, that title itself doesn't imply technology or gadgets or any of that. One of the recommendations, Frank, that you're making here is revising the definitions currently used and therefore the object of planning and review from a technology-based to an information-based regime. Now, I think that sums up exactly what Dan was talking about there. What's required to do that policy-wise, but also what's required to do that, I guess, culturally or worldview-wise, because that's not the way necessarily that CIOs see themselves, and it's not the way certainly that other CXOs in agencies see their CIO counterparts.
Yeah. Well, at this point, I'm not prepared to offer the solution to how we morph or evolve the role of the CIO as it has come to be defined in some agencies, although I'm in violent agreement with Dan that that the original vision was and I think needs to be realized as managing information. As to your question, let me again use Karen's wonderful formulation, and that is what we didn't say. What the recommendation about making information the focus isn't intended to do. And my analogy here would be to the management of national security information. The object of that set of policies is based on the sensitivity of information. Obviously, it has to be supported by a set of technology standards. The Defense Department prescribes the level of hardness of a safe or a room in which you store that information. So this isn't to suggest that there isn't a technology dimension, but rather that ultimately, regardless of where it resides, the agency is accountable for the security, the integrity, the availability of information with which it's that for which it is the steward.
Yeah, Karen, this is an issue that you've been on for a long time prior to your time at OMB, but certainly during your tenure there. This idea of how people perceive CIOs and the jobs that they're supposed to be performing compared to the jobs that they were actually performing. How does your vision and your history with that fit into the recommendations that come out in this report?
So I was really adamant about these recommendations, the pieces that you're talking about, the definitions, because I think the definitions will help change the culture within departments and agencies. Because if the IGs are going in and they are evaluating or auditing based on an information collection, and how you are managing that information collection would really change the dynamics. Right now, things get managed around systems. And so and the definition perpetuates that, because you were talking about a major information technology collection system. So things developed around, there's a financial system and there's an HR system, and you know, and you just keep yada yada, right? And so then you have a perimeter around it. Well, the same information about Karen Evans as the employee starts in the HR system and then has to traverse over into the financial system when she gets a paycheck. The gap between the two systems, if you think about it that way, that is what is being exploited. Because people know what their roles are within that perimeter. They don't know who's responsible when it goes in between the two systems. So what we're saying is that you should really have people in charge of the information till the handoff happens to the next group of people with the information, just like you do in the national security world. And so that would close down the gap, which then reduces the attack surface that can be exploited by our adversaries. And right now, we're helping perpetuate this by putting up perimeters that we don't really mean to have. So if you switch it that way, then that helps you really to think about, okay, who should be managing the information, how you should go across this. The other example that I like to use in this, and this goes back to Dan's piece about certification and accreditation and leads like into cloud services and everything else. You can have a parking permit system, right? And it can be certified and accredited up to a certain point. The reason why the risk level of a parking permit system changes, it's the location and the information of the data. A parking permit system for the Marine Mammal Commission is not necessarily as risky, right, as the parking permit system for the CIA or the National Security Agency. And the difference is the information in it, not the technical, you know, configurations of the parking permit system. So you can certify it up to a certain point. What changes it is the information.
So as she gives us that description, Dan, it strikes me that the whole approach to information and judging the level of security that information needs a revamp. And I don't recall that you explicitly said that, but that's what I'm taking away from some of the things that your team is writing here and from what Karen's talking about there.
Yeah, well, two pieces to that. One, to continue Karen's description of the information system, it's much more complicated than two. In an era where big data is everywhere, and there's analytics that can allow you to grab lots of information from lots of different systems in different combinations to make a transactional decision as an agency that you used to make just based on one system, means that you really want to look at information and how all the different systems come together and protect the information as it flows across all of those systems, as Karen said. The second part of your question with regard to how do we think about risk to that information as it travels across all of these systems is one that a different recommendation of our paper addressed, because Karen used the definition of the parking permit in a civilian agency relative to a national security agency. The policy regime that exists now, and this is in statute to some extent, requires a different set of or a different process for setting standards in the national security community and the civilian community. Recently, the government's gotten together through the goodwill of a lot of really good, talented federal executives and staff to sync up policymaking across civilian and national security because the risks do travel in that way. And so our recommendation there is to suggest that we ought to enshrine that behavior and that standard-setting policy process in how we develop policy in the future.
There's a lot more to the recommendations that you make, and I encourage anybody to read this because it is, first of all, very readable and just full of information. But I want to get, when we come back, to some of the logistics and mechanics of this, because I think it's instructive, adds some good context to the information that you're providing here. My guests in studio today, Karen Evans, Frank Reeder, and Dan Chenick, all of them co-authors, along with Jim Lewis and Alan Paller, of the publication Updating U.S. Federal Cybersecurity Policy and Guidance, released by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. It's linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and we'll continue our conversation in just a minute.
We have a big
reward
just for federal employees, a wellness incentive worth up to $50. And that's just one of the extra benefits at no extra cost with the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Service Benefit Plan. You also get everything from free annual physicals to generic drug incentives. To learn about our other
rewards
and about the wellness incentive, visit extras.fepblue.org or call 1-800-411-BLUE.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Who's staying and who's going in President Barack Obama's second term? Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner have both said they're eyeing the exits, but who will fill their shoes is still up for debate. Federal News Radio's Cabinet Tracker follows the latest news on cabinet secretaries and other top-level officials that plan to leave the administration. Plus, we bring you the list of their potential replacements. It's all at federalnewsradio.com. Search Cabinet Tracker.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, talking about a publication called Updating U.S. Federal Cybersecurity Policy and Guidance from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. My colleague Jason Miller, writing about it under the headline, Rewrite of Cyber Circular Aims to Break Some China. That's a quote from one of my guests today, Frank Reeder, and I'll ask you about that in a moment, Frank. Karen, you're quoted in Jason's story telling him, OMB didn't request us to do this. So the follow-on to that would be, what'd you do it for then?
Because we wanted to answer the question I get asked a lot. Jim Lewis, this is a logical follow-on to a lot of work that the Center for Strategic and International Studies did under the Commission for Cybersecurity for the 44th Presidency. I mean, one of the big questions was, okay, if legislation never passes, how do you institutionalize a lot of the good things that are currently happening now or the policy memos that OMB has had and make sure that it carries over from administration to administration to administration to administration since the last time this was changed was 2000. And, you know, my answer was it's A-130. All roads go back to A-130 short of legislation. And so the hierarchy to me as an agency person before I got to OMB is it's statute, OMB circular, policy memos. And if you want IGs to work with you, which is one of the big issues that CIOs have right now, and you've heard those arguments going back and forth, you've got to get the document that IGs are using in sync with the practices that the CIOs are implementing under the guidance of OMB and DHS.
Now, Dan, since you all have been here today, you've mentioned that the providence of this a number of times. Why is that important to you, in your view?
Well, as Karen mentioned, the discussions around the recommendations coming out of the CSIS process had a lot of influence in terms of how cybersecurity policy has gone forward. And the questions that are being asked don't wait for the pace of whatever the legislative calendar might have, because the threats are growing daily. The adversaries that would do harm to agencies don't wait for policy or discussion. They really act. And so our posture here was to come together without any formal association other than the fact that we were all associated with the CSIS process and say, here are some things that, based on our collective set of experiences, both in government and in cybersecurity, would be helpful to address that growing speedy threat in a way that can be implemented by agencies.
Yeah, and perhaps saying what my colleagues have already said far better, those of us who signed up and all of us served on the Cybersecurity Commission did so because we thought that the nature of the threat was such that we needed, shall we say, a different set of structures and actions than we saw currently in place. The two caveats, one or maybe one further word of explanation. For many of us, including those in this studio, but I suspect most of the members of the commission, it wasn't about writing a report, you know, a la the 9/11 commission. It was about actually making something happen. And that's really why we signed up to do this piece of work. The other caveat about the report was, and I hope we've made this clear, this was not an act of invention. It was more a journey of discovery. Almost everything you see in the report is, with, I hope, appropriate attribution, the work of a lot of really smart people in this town. What we were trying to do was focus attention on things like continuous monitoring, which we hardly invented.
And back to the conversation we had about that earlier, that continuous monitoring, as I mentioned, has any number of different definitions, depends who you ask and depends who's defining it. Is the definition issue a problem with other aspects of what we're trying to get our arms around in this field? Or does everybody pretty much universally agree on what most of the terms mean when one says something to another?
So I think that you can get lost in a semantic soup. Or you can understand that most of the problem is that information moves quickly, threats move quickly, you need to be able to respond quickly. However you define that, whatever terms you use, that is the number one priority in cybersecurity today and for the foreseeable future. And what we were trying to do is raise it up from that and say, how do you implement those principles as an agency in this environment?
My fear, though, is that if people are trying to have that conversation and don't hear this, what the other person intends in that conversation, that you wind up not achieving what it is that you want to achieve.
Apropos of Dan's comment about semantic soup, clarity about definitions is important, but and not to be dismissive, the nice thing about teaching and writing policy documents at OMB is you get to define the terms.
Mm-hmm.
Your obligation, you're then under an obligation to be clear about what those terms mean for the purpose of the conversation. But definitions do matter.
Well, and to add a little bit more on to this, if you really look at the basis of FISMA, the premise in there is not no one disagrees with what's in there, right? It's the definitions and how it rolled out. It's the implementation that ends up being discussed. And I think under the mantra of continuous monitoring, what you're really talking about today, when you go down and talk to a lot of people, it's a whole set of configuration management, those types of things, because agencies own assets. They own hardware. They own data centers. They own these things. 10 years from now, this policy document's still going to be there talking about continuous monitoring, and that's why we're saying that these other shifts in the back part of the document have to happen, because at that point, it's going to shift. And what you're really doing, and we mentioned this in here as well, which is the NIST publication of the Federal Information Processing Standards, you're measuring the level of risk. So today, what might be an acceptable level of risk for an information collection, next year is not. So it's that constant assessment of risk, and then what kind of controls are you putting in place to monitor and manage that risk? So it's taking it up another level, and then technology is just the way that you implement it.
And I think that the reason that matters is because all of this risk change profile, technology change profile, matters more and more for agency missions. It matters for how EPA does its air quality rules. It matters for how HHS delivers healthcare services, or how the Department of Transportation works with rail. All of those are now increasingly relying on technology that are at risk from different types of threats. And this type of approach can help. It's not just about technology or about monitoring or about cybersecurity. It's about the core mission elements of these agencies.
That's Dan Chenick. He's one of the co-authors of Updating U.S. Federal Cybersecurity Policy and Guidance. Frank Reeder and Karen Evans also in studio with me. And we'll wrap up our conversation about this document and the challenges that it tries to address when we continue in a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Government technology professionals should prepare to attend GovCom 2012, the trade show featuring government audiovisual communication solutions at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center, November 28th and 29th. Leading manufacturers and solutions providers will be showcasing the latest in audio-video, conferencing, collaboration, control systems, digital signage, and visual display technologies. GovCom will help you boost collaboration, enhance security, improve reliability, and cut costs. Seek cutting-edge communications products, get valuable training from leading experts in government and industry, and network with other professionals. Visit Government Video Expo, the leading show for government video and broadcast technology, now co-located with GovCom. For more information and your free exhibits pass, visit GovCom with two M's, show.org, and use the code FED. GovCom is brought to you by Infocom International, the Audiovisual Trade Association.
If you are facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7742.
The Washington Wizards are back.
Spins, fades, banks, scores, and one. Okafor.
Up court to Crawford. No-look pass. Ariza. Stump. Durant.
Crawford drives baseline. Whips it in the corner. Sheldon Mack for three.
Single game tickets are on sale now. Call 202-661-5050. That's 202-661-5050. Or buy your tickets online at washingtonwizards.com/tickets.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Looking at addressing changes in cybersecurity policy, specifically Circular A-130, and you can read more about it and why it's important at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. My guests in studio today are trying to address those changes and challenges with a document called Updating U.S. Federal Cybersecurity Policy and Guidance. Frank Reeder, Dan Chenick, and Karen Evans all in studio with me. Jim Lewis and Alan Powler contributing to this effort as well and could not join us today. Frank, I'm going to start with you. We just have a couple of minutes left, so give me your number one nugget that you want somebody to take away from this when they go read it.
Yeah, and this is really merely paraphrasing the report, part of which you quoted very nicely. Simply put, the thrust of the report is to suggest that we're spending a lot of money doing the wrong things. And even facing a fiscal cliff, it's not about wasting money, but rather in the sense that FDA wants to keep drugs that are not efficacious off the market because it keeps people from doing the right thing. Doing the wrong things in cybersecurity gives people a false sense of security, not simply waste money on doing those things.
Dan, what's your nugget takeaway?
So I would say that there are many things that could be done. What we've tried to do is take a number of steps that we think are will have significant near-term impact. And whether or not there are these particular steps or other steps, we would recommend that CIOs and CISOs and program leaders look at their risk profile and take steps that are necessary to secure their assets. And don't just sit back and wait for the IG to tell them something or to find out what they're supposed to do from elsewhere. Actually take action, and we think we've created a framework to do that.
So the last piece that Dan just talked about is about the IGs, and I wanted to hit a little bit on that. The IGs can be your adversary in this, or they can be your partner in helping strengthen the department and its cybersecurity position. And so the last piece that we put in here is a capability maturity model, which that framework we think will help that discussion so that you can meet the objective of what the secretary is being held accountable for. So it's not going to be one size fits all, but you can then roll this information up so that DHS then can look across the board and really ascertain what's the security posture for the federal government.
Frank, you are much too humble to take credit for this yourself, but your colleagues have told me off the air that you're the leader of this, and so you'll get the last word. You told my colleague Jason Miller that the ideas in this will break some china in the federal government. Why did you say that?
Well, and I won't attribute this view to any of my colleagues. One, there are a lot of people making a lot of money doing the wrong thing. So in that sense, it will break some china. And a recommendation we didn't focus on, although Dan alluded to it earlier, we're also suggesting revisiting the national security civil split that was, for understandable political reasons, embedded in the 1987 Computer Security Act. That will require a serious conversation, and in the view of some, may break some icons.
Jason writes about that pretty extensively in his story on this, which is headlined Rewrite of Cyber Circular Aims to Break Some China. And you can read that linked up. We'll bring it back up to the top at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, along with the Center for Strategic and International Studies document updating U.S. federal cybersecurity policy and guidance. Karen Evans, Frank Reeder, Dan Chenick, Jim Lewis, and Alan Paller all working on this as a team. The meetings must have just been outrageous. It must have been crazy.
Well, Frank and Dan and I got into OMB land, and Alan and Jim a couple times were wondering why they were there.
Having to drag you back, right, back to reality.
Yes, they did.
I want to thank you all for being here today. I really have enjoyed this conversation. There is a lot included here, and it's terrific to have your insight into what makes it all, why you're making these recommendations. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Francis.
Thank you, Francis.
Thank you.
You can hear this conversation at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. We'll archive it there for you to hear anytime you want. And hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose is coming in a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.